transportation group, and I wanted to share some thoughts from a recent trip with you, Rosalie. Hello. I have sort of one disclaimer to start with. I got to ask some really technical questions. I'm not a scientist by background. I am married to a chemical engineer, however, who has spent 19 years at Kennedy Space Center. So, my political opponents like to point out that I am no rocket scientist, and that's the truth. But I married one, which is the next best thing. And I want to share some thoughts with you about a recent trip that I was privileged to take. I am proud. Penn State really pulled sort of the Lazarus. They had a tough couple of years. Everybody fought for Joe Paterno's hand. Time for Joe to retire. Well, this year they started out of the top 50 programs in terms of preseason rankings and ended up on January 3rd playing my friends at Florida State University. My first speaker in the Florida House was T.K. Wetherall, a wide receiver years ago when Burt Reynolds played for Florida State University. I got to see a lot of my friends. The game took about 5.5 hours, and we got the right result, and Penn State is back on track, I'm delighted to say. I want to introduce Lee Arnold with my staff. Most of you know Lee. He does my space work in addition to a whole host of other things. Lee's our general counsel in the office, and anything you need space related. Now, Lee does have a good understanding of the technical aspects of space, and we'd be pleased to work with you. I want to talk for about maybe 20, 25 minutes, and then open it to questions and find out what's on your mind. I went to China for about 10 days, along with Mark Kirk and Rick Larson. Rick Larson is from Seattle. Mark Kirk is from outside the Chicago area. He's the northern suburbs of Chicago. Rick and Mark have started what they call a China Working Group. There are about 35 members, including me, signed up. The China Working Group doesn't take specific policy positions on China, whether it's, trade or the way they ought to value their yuan is a big issue now. The Schumer bill will punish them to the tune of a 47% tariff. We'll take positions on that, on the Taiwan Straits issue. As Mark Kirk likes to say, in the China Working Group, we have everybody from panda huggers to dragon slayers. I guess I would end up towards the other end. I happen to be a member of the Taiwan Caucus, for example. So, but what the China Working Group does do is to say that as we debate issues that affect a country of 1.3 billion people, we don't have the debates based on facts. This is no longer fighting the Cold War. The 1.3 billion people are growing their economy at a rate of about 9.4% a year. Those of you that have never visited China or haven't been to China in the last 10 or 15 years, you'll not recognize the place. They are becoming no longer a third world nation where most of the people live in poverty defined by the World Bank as less than $1 a day. This is a capitalist poverty elimination machine. It is incredible what they are doing. Shanghai now looks an awful lot like Hong Kong. Beijing looks an awful lot like Shanghai. Guangdong province, which is right across the river, literally from Hong Kong, has skyscrapers that make it look twice the size of Manhattan. And I think much of the eastern Chinese region is going to look like that. By the time they do the Olympics in Beijing in 2008, Beijing is going to be a world-class city, you can guarantee it. Now, they have a lot of problems. They're still backwards in the way they do rule of law. On the censorship side, the way they treat their people, this is really still a totalitarian, authoritarian regime. Those of you that read that Google, for example, has agreed with the Chinese government that they will censor what you can pull up as you do internet searches. Everywhere we went, we were surveilled. There were intelligence, we were confident that there were bugs in our phones, and you could just tell them. They are a very closed society in that respect. But we'll give you one quick example of how these guys are more capitalist in some respects than we are. If you are a low-level government official in a small city in China meaning less than 1 million people in it, it's a big city by our standards. And if your projected rate of gross domestic product growth in your city is supposed to be 7 or 8%, and you get 10 or 11% for the year, you get promoted, you become mayor of a larger city, ultimately governor of one of the 22 provinces. And eventually you end up in Beijing as one of the National People's Congress leaders. Can you imagine if we promoted our public officials based on the rate of economic growth in their areas? The economic understanding they have is laissez-faire, free market, classical liberal, not Ted Kennedy liberal, but classical liberal economics. is astounding. They could give lectures at any free market university, including the University of Chicago, which is probably the most free market of the major universities in theory. They have an incredible understanding, and they are putting this academic understanding into real live use. Their economy is growing amazingly. I'll give you one last example before we get to space. And by the way, there were a lot of things we did over there. We talked, amongst other things, about having a hotline between our Pentagon and Air Defense Department, which I think would be a very important step forward. Now, we have President Hu and President Bush have a hotline to one another. The State Department has a hotline to their Foreign Affairs Office, but a miscommunication between the defense agencies could be a huge problem, and we think that that would be an important step forward. Intellectual property. The Chinese are masters at copying and stealing things. And much of their economy is based on, number one, consumers getting stuff for 10 cents on the dollar because it is ripped off. 90% of the goods with Microsoft's name on it that you use in China, Microsoft never saw a nickel for them because it was simply copied by someone. The same thing, they reverse engineer anything we send them. Rick Morrison represents the corporate headquarters of Boeing. The Chinese will be purchasing something on the order of 2,500 major commercial airplanes in the next 10 years. Rick went thinking that his major opponent was Airbus, and everywhere he went, he wanted to make sure that Boeing was getting a fair, and he did a great job for you guys, thank them at Boeing. I think Mark came back thinking that 10 years from now, Boeing's major competitor will not be Airbus, it will be the Chinese themselves. They will be in the manufacturing business for commercial airplane, I predict, and they will do it quickly. And they will probably do a pretty darn good job. One last example. If you walk into a major retail store in the United States and you want to pick out a cell phone, you'll probably have about 12 or 13 different brands with maybe 60 or 70 different models to choose from. In China, you could go in any major city to a department store where there are 60 different brands and 1,000 different models to choose from. Motorola, who was saved by bankruptcy because of their profits in China, their regional directors told us that they would have been bankrupt 7 or 8 years ago had it not been for the profits that they made in China. Motorola told us that they will be rolling out their next generation of cell phones, and you can not only take pictures, but take pictures of somebody's business card, and it's already in your database. You can give them a business card back, you will not have to carry business cards around. They'll be rolling that out in China, and not the U.S. The average Chinese cell phone user buys a new phone every year, where the average American holds on to his or hers for about 3 years. Just a quick example of some of the dramatic improvements, and I'm not here to tell you that the Chinese economy is going to overtake ours anytime soon. Their average per capita income is about $1,300 per year. It's a lot more in the East, but they are redistributing income rapidly from the East to the West by building infrastructure and education throughout their Western provinces. And the gap is one of the most scary things to the Chinese leadership. They do not want a dramatic income gap where you've got enormous prosperity in the East and poverty in the West. But having said that, $1,300 buys you a lot more in China than it does in the United States of America. And we'll talk about that when we talk about the space budget. We met with, if we can turn the slide on, so we did a lot of things. So intellectual property was a big issue. Defense was a big issue. This is the head of the, this is Mr. Zhu Ejeng Gini, the Director General of, I'm sorry, I'm on the Foreign Affairs meeting first. Well, we spoke to the foreign minister to form with the National Space Agency. This is the head of their space agency. And the foreign minister understood that we were the first Americans ever committed to go see the Zhougang Space Facility. The Zhougang Space Facility is out. If you think about the United States, our political capital is Washington. Our business capital is New York. Their political capital is Beijing, their business capital is Shanghai, Hong Kong is still part of, is technically part of China, but Shanghai they look at as their mainland hub. If you consider flying from roughly New York or Washington out to, Boise, Idaho, that's where Zhougang City is located. And then from there you have to drive about 2 hours north into the Inner Mongolia, which is where their human space program is. No Americans have ever been permitted to visit there. The woman from the embassy that was sent to escort us was probably kicked off the bus and forced to stay in the hotel while Rick and Mark and I were the first Americans ever permitted to go see the human spaceflight program. The reason for that is no less than officials, including the French, for example, that are doing a work, they're having some of their satellites set up by the Chinese, have ever been permitted to the human spaceflight program. And the reason is, if you remember after Tiananmen in 1989, the United States cracked down on technology transfers that have affected a lot of your companies. We convinced a lot of our partners in the West to do the same. The Chinese, to retaliate, didn't have a whole lot of options. One of them was to deny access to their human space flight program. They started heavily in the human space flight program business in around 1995-1996. The building that you'll see that we got to tour wasn't completed until, I think, 1998-1999. So they were able to basically do all this in a vacuum. Other than our satellites and things that fly over and can take pictures from above, no American has ever seen the facilities that we were able to see before. Now, a lot of this was done in retaliation because they're very proud of what they've done. But we were the first Americans ever to go. The foreign minister was very anxious to welcome us. We talked about one of the things with the foreign minister, before I get directly to space, the effects space. We talked about the desirability from an American perspective and from a space perspective. Now, our defense guys, they have a very different opinion of having a mutually useful docking device, like the Russian Soyuz has with our space station. The Chinese are going to have a space station in the next 10 or 15 years, I would guess. And we talked about how it would be mutually beneficial if our capability was to dock with the Chinese space station, if their capability to dock with our space station in the event of the need of a mutual rescue. Now, we may decide, because of relations at the time, you know, they may be disastrous, and they may decide not to rescue somebody at the ISS. We may decide not to rescue somebody at the Chinese space facility. But we ought to have the docking capability. And the Chinese know how to do this because they steal, borrow, get technology from the Russians on a daily basis. And so they know how to do this. They're anxious to do this. The Minister of Foreign Affairs said that they would like to do it, but obviously he said that was a decision for a higher pay grade. I think a lot of our NASA guys said, he asked them privately, would like to do this, but they're understanding concerns of any technology being used jointly with the Chinese that the Defense Department has. This is a debate raging within the Pentagon itself. On the 11th of January, we went to see Minister Liu Jiang. This is him. He is handing me. Do we have a copy of the? This is the. This is the Shenzhou vehicle that he is handing me, and you're welcome after this to come up and take a look at this. The Chinese are obviously enormously proud of the success they've had. One of the reasons that we've not been anxious to cooperate with the Chinese is that 15 years ago they didn't have a lot of value to add to our human space flight program, and they haven't really proven or demonstrated anything. And Shenzhou has flown it now, as Minister Ji told us, six times, four times in unmanned vehicles. The first manned trip was one man who spent, I think, 5 hours in space. And then last year, they had two Taikonauts spend 5 days orbiting in space. The Shenzhou is a larger version of the Apollo or the Soyuz. It's very similar. Not everything has been copied from the Russians or the Americans. For example, the Shenzhou and their vehicle has four engines, whereas the Apollo had one, and the Russian Soyuz has one engine and one backup. So what they do is they steal what they want to steal in terms of the technological capability, and they reinvent what they want to reinvent. The Chinese space suit, for example, is a Russian space suit. They didn't even bother to change the colors. But when they want to design something new and from scratch, they do. And this is a model that's going to show again that you're welcome to come up and take a look at. Mr. Ji told us, I can tell you that everywhere we went, the attitude of Chinese officials towards their space program was huge pride. The Taikonauts over there are sort of heroes in the sense that Joe DiMaggio, if he were living, and Michael Jordan, and Johnny Unitas, all wrapped up in one. I mean, the fact that the Chinese were able to do this establishes them in their own minds, you know, the national pride and the unity. Chinese officials, and I don't want to talk about defense this morning the whole time, but Chinese officials do not get up every day worried that Taiwan is going to start a war, the United States is going to attack them. Their number one worry, and it's their top 10 worry, is that there's going to be some sort of massive uprising or rebellion within China itself. There are thousands of riots every year in China, often disparate causes, whether it's lack of freedom of religion or democracy, whether it's poverty, displacement. I mean, they're picking up people and just moving them physically because they're making room for the Olympics. They're building subways and they're being all over the Beijing. You just pick people up and move them. Now, housing there has got 95% subsidized for the lower income class. So, you know, they figure if we're paying for your housing, we'll tell you where to live. But it's not exactly the same property rights division that we have in the United States. But they don't wait for the lawyers to resolve the issue. They need to build a subway, you get moved. It's that quick. Developers have no problem if they have the Chinese government on their side. So the pride that their space program gives them is enormous. And they have these national heroes, the Taiwan Ops, the three of them now, are really just national, you know, idols. Just like we have American idols, well, there's your astronauts. Taiwan Ops is what they call them. The second thing you need to know about their attitude is the only time they don't engage in enormous pride is when you start comparing the Chinese program to the American program. At that point, they get very humble. I think partly because they do not want to be a threat, and partly because they do not want to overly excite expectations that they cannot live up to. One of the things they told me very interesting about the Shoshen vehicle is that they had run quite a number of simulated flights. Now, this is very interesting to me. I represent the National Center for Modeling and Simulation in Orlando, Florida. I know we do a lot of simulation before we would ever send anything into space. But the fact that they have had, they told us they had a lot of successful simulated flights, and then they had these successful flights. And Mr. Day, again, was very proud. But he reminded us when we started talking about the U.S. program that they only have about an 8-year history in human flight. The U.S. and Russia have 30 or 40 years, respectively. They only have 100 launches total, including all of their satellite launches, so 60 satellite launches, which is, as they put it, much less than the U.S. They have a lot of plans for the future, aside from the human space flight program. They want to be able to launch satellites that can look down on Earth. Right now, their resolution is only capable to about 20 meters of accuracy. They want to get that down to about 4 or 5 meters. This obviously has huge ramifications for our defense agencies. They're very interested in things like oceanography, space science, meteorology. They told us that they have 4 steps regarding the moon. The first is that they want to orbit the moon, which they hope to do in the next couple of years. The second is that they want to land on the moon, an unmanned landing. By the way, the Chinese space program is working, they tell us, with 100 different academic institutes. They've got 100 different universities doing different things related to space. They want to land on the moon, an unmanned landing, and then finally, they want to take a sample and be able to return that sample to Earth. And then, of course, stage 4, which is at a date yet to be determined, will be to land a man or a woman or both on the moon. They don't have a date for that. They talk about the year 2020 as sort of a rough goal. Those of us that saw their program believe that they are being very conservative in terms of what they would like to do. If they keep having successes, my guess is that they may be there, significantly before the year 2020. Very hard to tell in terms of exactly what they have planned, but they are being conservative, and they say 2020 is something they'd like to do. Let me go back for a second. The 100 universities, as we talk about them landing on the moon, they described to us at various times 4 or 5 different vehicles that are being worked on that can transport things or survey the moon. One would be sort of a heavier vehicle that would be able to collect a lot of things and then bring that back to their orbital and then come back to Earth. Others would be lighter things that would have the ability to go much further out on the moon. The fact that they're working not on one, but 4 or 5 or maybe 10 or a dozen different types of crafts, vehicles that can rove around the moon, I find very fascinating. They obviously want to have a very versatile set of capabilities, and who knows which ones they'll end up using, but they are clearly thinking way down the line in terms of what they'd like to be doing. They talked about cooperation with the U.S. They were very proud that the first country they ever cooperated with in space was the United States. Obviously, we had, as they referred to it, the troubles, sort of like the Irish used to talk about the bombings. They referred to it as the troubles surrounding Tiananmen. And everywhere we went at the highest leadership, we met with the premier, who's the number two guy in China, they talked about the desirability of cooperating in space. They talked about the enormous expense, the enormous risk, and the advantages of cooperation on those things that we want to do together. They are working with a number of other countries. I'll go through this very quickly. Latin America, especially Brazil, they have a program with the European Union, where they launched satellites of four. Again, the EU officials have not been able to see the facility that Mark and Rick and China and Russia cooperation has been constant over the years. Most of the Chinese engineers have been trained in Russia, going back to the 50s and 60s in terms of their engineering capabilities and background. And they have an Asian program, finally, including Taiwan, believe it or not, Pakistan and Korea, that has some space cooperation between the different branches. Let's go to the next slide. This is at the facility. Before I leave that, in order to do the next generation of what they want to do, put men and women in orbit for a substantial period of time, reach the moon, they need a larger lift vehicle. Right now they have what they refer to as a Long March 2. What you're going to see here is a Long March 2 at the Jovan Space Facility. They're going to have a Long March 5. Long March 5 is big enough that it will be able to launch, I think it's 20 tons, Lee, into space, if I'm not wrong. And it will be too big to transport to where we are looking at right now. They are building their fifth space launch center in Funan, which is an island south of China. It's a beautiful area. It's being heavily developed there in Macau. Anybody who thinks Las Vegas is something, wait to see Macau after the next couple of years. Steve Lin, developers of Diageo, they're all over there building the most beautiful hotels in the world. Macau. Well, just west of there is the rather large island area, Hunan, where they're going to have their space facility. They have no way to transport over rail or anything else. The size of the rockets that they want to use. So eventually they will be launching men and women, and especially heavy launch craft and shuttle equipment, not from this facility, but from the Hunan facility, which they tell me is at various stages as we ask questions. We got answers like, well, it's under development or it's under study. And so I guess those are the same thing in terms of what they're willing to tell us publicly at this point. But clearly our guys in the sky are able to keep a good eye on that. It has 120 tons of thrust. It would be necessary to put a man on the moon. In other words, this new launch vehicle will probably go out of Hunan and not the Jovan space facility. Jovan is in the middle of nowhere. It's not the end of the earth. You can see it from here. We're in Inner Mongolia right now. We had to fly, as I said, about 4 hours from Beijing. The U.S. Embassy official accompanying us was a woman by the name of Colleen Kelly. We deliberately selected somebody who didn't have an intelligence background, didn't have a specific background in space technology. We wanted somebody to just sort of make a car, escort, make sure we didn't get lost. Well, they made sure she got lost. They took her off the bus at 7 in the morning, and she sat in the lobby for 9 hours while we traveled about 3.5 hours by bus on a cold day. We're in the middle of the desert. It's minus 20 degrees. You would not want to live in this place. In the summer, it gets up to 100. In the winter, it's minus 20 all the time, and it gets a lot colder at night. We happened to be there on a beautiful day, unfortunately, and behind us is what they call their vehicle assembly structure or vehicle assembly building, equivalent of our VAB. This fellow here is General Lee. He used to be the Jim Kennedy, the head of the base here. Everything in the Chinese space program is under their Defense Department, technically their Defense Procurement Department. General Lee was the head of all of the Defense Procurement Agency, but for about a 5-year stint, he was head of the base here at Jovan. Jovan is named after a city 180 miles away.
The reason for that is there's not anything significant within 180 miles from here. You might ask me our Kennedy Space Center after Tampa Bay or something. I mean, this is a long ride, but there is nothing between one and the other. The other thing I thought was fascinating is I probably saw 1,000 soldiers on the way. Again, there's nothing to guard between the city we left and the space facility, but at every intersection, we had this escort, and really rather remarkable the lengths that they go, because as far as I can tell, this is the only thing worth defending. General Lee is now a member of the National People's Congress. He's in the Foreign Affairs Committee. He's a highly respected three-star general. It was his decision to have this vehicle vertical at all times. They fuel it vertical, they test it their vertical, and they move it vertical out to the launch facility, all of the fuel. Rather something, you know, we haven't engaged in with respect to human rockets. General Lee also, while he didn't ever admit this, we had 34 meetings in 6 cities in 7 days. General Lee's job was to go, as we left one meeting, he'd be in the car ahead of us, briefing the people at the next meeting. In terms of exactly what we were talking about, what we were interested in, what was said, if there were any unexpected developments. So it was like, in all 34 meetings, having a continuous conversation. You met new people with different titles, the defense minister, the commerce minister, but it's just like you left the last conversation because General Lee had fully briefed the people. So clearly his job was to watch us in every sense of the word and watch what we were doing. He spent 3 hours with us on the ride up. An hour and a half was very productive talking about space. An hour and a half was our official lecture for the tour on Taiwan and China. So we'll skip the Taiwan, China lecture tour. Let me go through some of my notes here. When the vehicle comes back to Earth with the Taikonauts, they leave the solar panels up with a small device that continues to do work, as they put it, for 6 months, different types of satellite-capable work. They have been doing some experiments during their 5 days of two Taikonauts tour. The next trip, they expect to do a lot more experiments while they were up there. Let's go to the, what's the next picture, please? This is again General Lee, Mark Kirk. Steve Orleans is with the U.S.-China Relations Committee. He was the only other American with us on this tour, and they were the sponsor of our trip. Lee, for the next picture. Okay. This is the picture of the facility with the vehicle coming out or going in. General Lee, by the way, told me that he had been to the launch facilities at Kennedy Space Center, the French launch facilities, the Russian launch facilities, the Japanese launch facilities. Again, these guys study everything that anybody is doing before they decide whether either to copy it or modify it or start from scratch. They are masters at that. I compare this while they say they've only been in the human spaceflight program for 5 or 6 years. It's sort of like saying they've only been in the TV business in Japan for 10 years. And the truth of the matter is that we've been in the TV business in America since the 50s. But what the Chinese have done in space is the equivalent of jumping straight to high-speed TV or plasma TV. They have skipped generations of the experiments that we have made, but they have studied everything that we've done. Everybody we met with at a high level in space had been at Kennedy, they had been all over the United States, they had studied ad infinitum everything we have done, everything the Russians have done, so they've learned from our successes and failures, they're very capable. Some of the fascinating things about what they've done, by the way, I think if we were going to build a vehicle assembly building today, it would look an awful lot like what they have done. I mean, our VAV is a 60-year-old huge warehouse or garage, basically. And there, as I will show you pictures of the inside, it's like working in a beautiful modern office building. But if you're an engineer working up there, I can guarantee you spend a lot of time at work. Because like I just told you, within 3 hours drive, there is nothing else to do. And the only nice place is the place you work. So, you'd be committed. Go back for just a second, Lee. They do 100% of their tests on the vehicle in the building. They don't roll it out and then do a countdown for 2 weeks and then the 24-hour countdown and continue to do testing. They fuel the rocket in the building. I'm going to put the fuels there, and then they do the test while it's sitting there. And then, while this bird fully fueled, fully tested on the pad, it takes them less than 60 minutes to get them out the door about 1,000 meters, so about 8 meters per second apparently, 500 meters, 1,000 meters, and then they have their rocket in place. Now imagine the implications for that in terms of a rescue mission. If you could have a bird fuel-tested, ready to go at 60 minutes from launch, you know, pretty dramatic compared to the capabilities that that we have. So we want to go to the next one, Jeff. Yeah, thanks, Rich. Inside their building, I compared it to a modern professional office building. Inside, we probably have 4 or 5 offices in our VAD, as huge as it is. Our VAD is roughly twice the size of the Chinese VAD, but the functionality of theirs, given their vehicle, is really remarkable because they built and designed the vehicle at the same time that they did the VAV. On each level here, you're looking, in this case, from slightly below, the other case slightly below, there are 13 different elevation paths. Each one is full of testing offices or engineers' offices that are adjacent to the vehicle at all 13 stories. So they can just flap down one of these connectors, and there can be 8 or 10 or 15 engineers on every level here of 13 different stories that literally have access to the vehicle. So, you know, I asked Jim Kennedy when he saw these pictures, I said, you know, how excited would your workforce be if your engineers and your testing people literally were working next to the shuttle every day getting ready for launch? He said that would be like unbelievable. It'd be heaven. Our folks are, you know, 10 miles away in a facility, 5 miles away. It looks thoroughly modern. I am, again, not a technical guy, so I have no idea what their capabilities are here, but it's a beautiful, modern facility, and it would look an awful lot like probably what we would do if we were doing it today. This is the platform that it gets fueled on, tested on, and then transported on. It's 2 railroad tracks that go straight out to the pad. They have 2 bays. There's not just one, but 2. So they can be working on 2 vehicles at a time. The one bay, the tracks go out about a couple hundred yards, and then they turn and they get back on the main set of tracks that takes them straight out to the pad. Why don't we go to the next one? You can sort of see the distance as we come out. This picture is probably taken from the top of their launch facility, so you can get a sense for the distance. It's probably a little bit under a mile. And this is a picture of the vehicle again coming in or out of the building, and you can see how the building just perfectly fits the vehicle. Basically, these things were designed, obviously developed, and General Lee was proud to take credit for, you know, how all this works. Next set of slides. Again, this is a picture. We're very close to the launch facility here of Rick Larson from Washington, Mark Kirk, and I. Lee, next picture. This is their launch pad, obviously. It was very simple. I mean, the Chinese have not gone to great lengths to do anything, you know, that looks, you know, 300-year futuresque. They have basically designed stuff that's very simple. Their Shen vehicle, their launch facility, everything is done with the basic simplicity but the highest technical capabilities that they could borrow from somebody else or develop on their own. Let me talk about that workforce for a second. The Chinese budget, they say total, from the time they started their program in 95 or 96, they say total is about $2.5 billion U.S. dollars. Doesn't sound like a lot. My guess is that they're spending, you know, between $1 billion and $2 billion a year now. A couple things to keep in mind. Number one, they're not transparent at all. This is all done under the military budgets. They can be doing as much or as little as they like through the DoD and not telling us. And they, of course, they're not honest about what they're spending on defense. They admit to having a 12.5% increase in defense over the last year, but it may be significantly more than that. Number two, $1 billion in China goes an awful long way, and a lot further than it does in the U.S. You can pay 8 engineers on average, not just in the aeronautics field, but on average you can pay 8 engineers in China for the same cost you can hire 1 engineer in the United States. And other labor, manual labor, is a lot less expensive in China than an 8-to-1 ratio. So their costs of doing business are dramatically low. If they're spending $8 billion a year on human space, that'd be the equivalent of us spending, perhaps $8 or $9 billion a year. And remember that the proposed budget that we're talking about today in the Science Committee only has about $4.5 billion for human space flight. So if you use numbers like that, they are very competitive, if not, exceeding what we are doing in human space. Another thing I would point out is that we have a great workforce. They talk about our management skills, they talk about how excellent we are, and we're the model, and how far behind they are. That may be true, that may be just, self-bad-mouthing to not look too competitive or scarce. But the young Chinese workforce has a different job than much of the American, newly hired workforce. Much of our workforce has been hired to maintain 20 or 30-year-old technology. Their young workforce has been creating new capabilities and technology. They have created this program in the last 8 years. I think there's a qualitative difference that we have to talk about in terms of what it means to be, an engineer who's maintaining 30-year-old technology versus a young engineer who has created a shuttle that has had 6 straight successful launches. Next slide. You can see in the background their other launch facility is what they use for satellite launches. They do not use that if it's the older one. They told us it's been refurbished, so they obviously still use it. Remember, they've sent about 100 rockets up. But this is only one of their 4 launch facilities. Their 5th launch facility, again, will be the new one down at Hunan, which will be used for the heavy launch, Long March 5 vehicle. Okay. The exhaust pads are underneath here. They're very simple. They look a little bit like ours at Kennedy Space Center, where you have all the exhausts as the bird goes off, and they go in 2 directions. They're just straight out underneath. It's huge walls of concrete, and you can see the burns and everything. And that's within the gate there. We were able to go and look down in there. But again, very basic, simple design. Nothing fancy. Next. That's sort of a more detailed view. We did not get to go up in the, they have elevators that take you up, but we did not, I don't know if it was, we didn't have any time constraints. We were stayed for 2 days. By the way, when they set this up, they wanted us to travel 3 hours by bus for a 30-minute tour and then come back. We said, no, we have more time than that. So it took a lot of negotiations to get that done. We ended up spending an hour and a half there. The other interesting thing, Lee, let's move forward. You have, we are really in the desert, if you don't believe me. 2 quick stories here. Here are the names of the, I can see the photo of the current center director and the vice director. They may not be in the slides. We met with the current center director and the vice director. And the interesting thing to me is while they welcomed us there, we got to go and sit in the office building, or actually a conference center. They both apologized because it was a big thing for those of you that have visited China. You number one, not only had a business card for everybody, but you treated it with respect. Your business card to somebody, they put it and you look at the thing and you respect the thing. This is like a picture to somebody's child. You have to treat it like that. And these guys didn't have business cards. Well, the reason is they don't do any business. Nobody visits them. They left there for 8 years. They never had visitors. So there's a new reason for them to have business cards, but I thought that was interesting. We're riding the camels later in the afternoon. We're back at the end of the Great Wall. You remember the Silk Trail where Marco Polo came through? Well, believe me, that was back in civilization. We were 3 miles, 3 hours a drive from there, about 150, probably 200 miles, if I had to guess. One last thing, and then we'll take questions. Exotic food over there. Every meal is served when you have meals with the Chinese officials in about 11 or 12 different small plates or courses. In the middle, there's a rotating table with stuff that you can use your chopsticks to access. One night they explained to us that we had camel toe, after we had eaten it, sort of an interesting dish. But probably the most interesting dish I'll share with you, now that you've had your meal, I wouldn't have told you. The weirdest thing that I know of that I ate was a lobster. And it was lobster sushi. And I love sushi, and I love lobster. You can't go wrong there. But it's the way Larry the Lobster was served. Larry the Lobster, who's a huge Australian lobster, was severed in the middle. And the inside was set out so that we could access it. And Larry the Lobster was stood up, hollow,
with his hands and eyes looking at you and moving, and he joined us for the entire meal. So, anyway. Well, I don't know what we're yelling about. I don't have to describe that reaction, but we're going to leave it in or out in the next set of kids. Can we go to questions about anything that we saw or were there? Yes. By the way, thanks again for coming. Now, this is something I think is really important. The Chinese are very serious about this.
Thank you. It's an incredibly substantive talk for breakfast. It's great to hear you. And if Al Kamen needs any fodder for people going on trips that are not junkets, so I think you ought to submit this. I have a question because you've been fairly outspoken, I think, in the sense that we in this country have to balance our priorities within the space program and how does shuttle fit in there. When you go to China, and it sounds like you're more interested in cooperation than maybe others have talked about, how would you balance that with the fact that it seems like some of what the reason we might get additional funding for space is thinking of China as competitors? And a lot of people talk about bringing China back as the race back to the moon like we did the first time in the Cold War. It sounds like you maybe feel the opposite, that cooperating with them.
No, I would say this. I actually asked the question to Donald Rumsfeld. I said, how do you deal with China?
Number one, I don't think we should look, I think it's a mistake to look at China as an extension of the Cold War. This is not the Soviet Union. Their history for several thousand years, once you draw the borders that they now have, including Taiwan, which they think is their 23rd province, but if you give them Taiwan, you know, for debate's sake, they've not been an aggressive country since Genghis Khan was running things. So unlike other hegemonic powers, the Chinese have been traditionally very concerned about what they have. I don't think we should assume that these guys are enemies. But
by the same token, these guys have the economic and military potential to be the equivalent of Imperial Japan and Nazi Germany 100 years ago. They've got that kind of economic development potential, in which they were doing very rapidly. And their military modernization program happened after Tiananmen. This is all part of their military modernization program, so I don't think we can be in any way Pollyannish about this. I would say, and Rumsfeld's answer was, Tom, and I wasn't talking about space, so sort of how we treat China in general. A couple of things to know about China. They don't think in terms of the next quarter's profits. They think in terms of the next decade or century. When they say they want to resolve the Taiwan Strait issue, I got the sense that they're not talking about the next 5 years. They'd be perfectly happy to have the status quo for the next 50 years, as long as it's resolved at some time in the next 3,000 years on their terms. I think they'll be satisfied. It's if Taiwan starts moving towards independence and we have real problems, including potential military action, and they made clear that that would be what their reaction, military response. And they knew what we would do. Or they know what we expect to do. What Rumsfeld essentially said is that every time the Chinese behave, we ought to reward them. And every time they misbehave or wander off the path, there ought to be some sort of a sanction or price to pay. While we were over there, the highest official to date had said that they had the same interest in Iran in terms of having a non-nuclear Iran as the United States of America. We pressed them. Does that mean if we go to the Security Council that you will vote for sanctions? And at that point, which was remember January probably 11th or 12th, this is with the premier, who is the equivalent of the Senate president and the speaker all roll up in one. We only have one legislature over there, and it's 2,200 members. So this guy next to President Putin is the number one guy. And the premier said, we have the same goals as you. We still want to give talks a chance. But he affirmed that their policy was the same as ours. The Chinese, we told, and in a very respectful way, that they cannot be a global respected power and also behave like a third world, Timor dictator. These guys have an amoral foreign policy. They will buy oil from anybody. They don't care how you treat your own people. They have their own serious civil rights problems. That's a whole other lecture. But the bottom line is, I think Rumsfeld has right. We have to be very cautious. We have to watch everything they do. We have to urge them to be more transparent. What they do with respect to military modernization is, in some respects, understandable. As General Lee told us when we asked him about the rapid increase in expenditures in military modernization, he said, for 20 years under Deng Haiping, we've been making all these changes from the old Mao communist way to what they call the socialist free market.
very little socialism to be found in their economic policy. It's all free market. California policymakers could learn from these guys. That's just my own editorial. But having said that, he said that for 20 years, the military was told, you're going to fall behind in pay, we're not going to focus on you, but they had been neglected. So they were basically claiming they're playing catch-up. We don't buy that because they're buying submarines, they're increasing their air capabilities, their aircraft carriers. My personal view on the military is if they're spending a lot of money to enhance their 200 million person strong army, they've got legitimate issues on all their borders and they're entitled to a defensive army. It's that they're building a naval capability, an air strike capability that goes beyond their geopolitical region, that I think that we have a real problem with that, and we're going to deal with that. So my view is a very nuanced view, that we're going to have to pay attention to everything they do, whether it's in space or intellectual property, that we're going to have to constantly put pressure on them, engage them when we can. But something as simple as having joint docking capability doesn't seem to me commits us to sending them technologies that they can use to launch first strike capabilities against us. Rumsfeld had just been there in the fall, and he got to look at, the Chinese saying, every single one of the 36 missiles that can hit the United States from China. You got to go tour them. That kind of transparency and openness, to the extent it's full, I think is a good thing. And we pressed them in space to do the same thing. Yeah?
Kind of a follow-up to what Lori asked. Do you sense that your fellow members of Congress have any great angst about the speed with which the Chinese program is picking up, and if the Chinese were able to land something on the moon before we were, do you think that would be a cause of concern, or do they, because we've been to the moon already, do you think your fellow members aren't really all that upset about it?
I think some members would be motivated by that, let's put it that way. But I think more likely the motivation would come from the people of the United States. I mean, there is a competitive American spirit out there. I think that we have some members that would say, so what? We've been there, done that. They're, 40 years behind us. I'll tell you, two assumptions that I make. You don't understand what my biases are as we go forward with the Chinese relationship. Number one, I think a significant part of the history of the 21st century will be based on the relationship, for good or bad, between U.S. and China. I mean, I think it would be a major story in the first 50 years, perhaps as important as terrorism. And secondly, I believe that space predominance is absolutely requisite to maintain our military security. I think for the first several millennia of human history, whoever had the best army could assert or protect its interests. For about 300 years, whoever had the best navy, one of the 13 choke points on the planet, the British built their empire on the back of their navy. The last 6 years has been air superiority. It gave force multipliers to our troops on the ground. I think space predominance. If you think about our weapon systems, our aircraft carriers, our fighters, and our bomber pilots, they are almost totally dependent now on satellite capability. And if that is neutralized, one of the things that the Long March 5 capability is so important for us strategically is that the Chinese can launch parasatellites or killer satellites to attach to ours and perhaps undetected and then destroy our satellites, on call or maybe attack in a comprehensive way. Land-based capability to undermine our satellites. I mean, not only won't you be able to withdraw money from your ATM machine that day, but it may be the day that a serious problem breaks out if the Chinese decide to assert that capability. And clearly, their human space program has applications in terms of their ability everywhere else. Yeah, I don't know if I, So I would tell you two things. One of the reasons I decided to focus on China is that there are a lot of members of Congress that, for a variety of their background or professionally or interests, are experts in the Middle East and terrorism, et cetera. There are a lot that have a background with NATO and Europe. There are an awful lot that have a background in places like Latin America, and some that have a keen interest in Africa. But given the fact that two-thirds of the world's population and the fastest economic growing region on the planet is in the Far East, from India on East, I decided by default that I was going to focus on those issues, and not just space, but everything. Yeah, that is good.
I was actually in China myself around Thanksgiving time, so I can totally appreciate your desire to not ask what you were eating. just kind of want to almost turn that question around a little bit and ask, did you get a sense at all that they see this program as a competition or sort of a animosity towards the United States? A lot of our rhetoric out here is almost sort of animosity and trying to find a motivator to get the U.S. to respond to this. Do they see this as sort of almost a defensive defensive competition, or is this more sort of national prominence and sort of making themselves a worldwide player on the civil side, or is it more of an extension of defense?
No, their official line, and they were very good actors at sticking to this, and you know, with some genuine sincerity, is that they have enormous pride in their space program. Again, this unifies the country. This has a huge benefit to them, because their number one goal, and their top 10 goals, as I told you earlier, is domestic stability. If they can have 1.3 million people all get behind the Taekwondo's as national heroes, as a success of the unified national government, that's the biggest advantage on a day-to-day basis that they have. They're enormously proud of this. Every time you talked about, they're very careful about getting into a competition, because every time you say, well, you're doing this and the U.S. is doing that, they get very humble. Oh, well, we're far behind you. Oh, well, we don't have the background there. Oh, we're learning from you. We're watching, and we're just the first step, and you're up here on the ladder. I'll give you one example. I asked them. I've been out to the, I think it's the 4th, I didn't get them mixed up, 45th Space Wing in Colorado Springs, where we, the 25th. Space Command, where we track some 8,000 pieces of space junk. We would never send a shuttle with human beings in it until we had run that shuttle around the Earth in our models, you know, a couple thousand times to see what the likelihood is of a baseball-sized, you know, piece of junk running into our shuttle door. We just never do that. We have that capability, and I asked General Lee, I said, how do you account for things when you send humans into space like the space junk that's up there, and do you have any models? All he would basically say is that they are developing a program, but they are far behind the United States. So they want to be totally non-competitive with their official line. The third aspect of this is international pride. I think the Chinese pride was hurt when we declined to cooperate with them on the, among other things, at least the implied theory that they didn't have anything to add to our space program 10 or 15 years ago. They couldn't have anything for us. Why would we worry about it? I mean, we have the concerns about defense. We got the red bashers, or the dragon slayers, as Kirk puts them. And so why cooperate? What's in it for us? Well, the Chinese think they have something in it for us now. And, they are very proud of the international prestige, which they see on a whole host of issues, but they think in space and science and technology, this puts them on the world stage. They're very proud of it. But we didn't get the sense ever in a competitive way. You know, it's never like, we're going to beat you to the moon, or we're going to beat you to Mars, or it was never that. Just that they're taking baby steps. You know, again, their attitude towards the way they address these things. As soon as you talk about the U.S., very humble, but up until then, they bragged about their Michael Jordan and their Johnny Unitas and their they're Joe DiMaggio. Very proud of their accomplishment. Yes?
Do you get a feeling how they take safety? So this would be an indicator of how much risk they're willing to take with the management.
Well, we talked about safety. They have an escape capability from their vehicle, which is something, of course, is going to be very important in our CEV. We talked about escape from the pad itself. Like ours, it was a very, it wasn't a high-tech system where you push a button in some spacesuit takes you, 10 miles away from the launch pad before it blows up or anything. You know, we've got basically these ropes that our astronauts, hook themselves onto and they slide down. And they've got something very similar to that. We didn't talk a whole lot about safety. Other than what their alternatives are. And they do have four engines on their vehicle, which in and of itself is a significant safety asset. Again, our Apollo had one.
Does having the assembly, the fuel loading, while you're dealing with all these prophecies you mentioned during your life.
Oh, and the fuel well? It would be a huge issue over here. I don't know that we'd probably have a dozen agencies that would have some serious issues with that. But maybe I'll insert a little bias here. The Chinese traditionally haven't respected human life the way we have. But on the other hand, so what their incentives are there or their motivations, it's hard to judge. But on the other hand, the prestige factor. They do not want an incident at Jogon. They do not want an incident with any of their pyconauts while he or she is up in their vehicle. So even if they've got plenty of pyconauts to spare in their own minds, they do not want an incident. And so for that reason alone, I think that safety would be very important there. Well, thank you very much. We really